Hey everybody, it's Chris Spangle here. Welcome to the Chris Spangle Show. If I sound different, it's because I'm playing with a new toy. Special thanks to Craig DaCosta. He sent, what is this? A Zoom field recorder and lav mic. Zoom is like the best radio... Like if you're going to do podcasting, Zoom recorders are the best thing you can possibly use. And so I'm sitting in my easy chair. Normally, you know, the studio is like 6 feet away over at my coffee table. And so studio is something I use loosely. I have in my apartment, I have like an 800 square foot apartment in Indianapolis. And hi Mittens, my co-host Mittens stopping by. And so in the dining area, I have the podcast studio set up. If you go back and watch on the YouTube channel some of the older videos, then you can see what the room actually looks like. But I have made it look like it's an actual studio, so I fool you on YouTube when we post those clips. And please, I would love for you to go subscribe to our YouTube channel. I'm trying to get to 1,000 so we can start monetizing videos. And then basically, like, I'm at $20 earned on AdSense, so basically I'd like to earn $80 so I can get $100 out of that thing at least. But I don't expect that we'll ever make a lot of money on YouTube, but it'd be great if you went and subscribed. We're doing a lot of cool stuff, like Fundamental Freedoms with Sarah Brady Wagner. Our third episode aired last night, every Sunday night at 8 p.m. We've got a new YouTube series that's on YouTube, Vimeo, Twitch, and Facebook. So you can check WeAreLibertarians.com for all those things. We post all of the network shows, including all of We Are Libertarians, up there. Full videos of We Are Libertarians, full audio of all the other shows like this. So if you're at work and you can't listen on your phone for whatever reason, you can listen on YouTube, on our YouTube channel, to all of our podcasts. What was I saying? But yes, I have a studio over there, and that's normally where I sit. But I wanted to try this thing out because at the end of the month, I am going to Orlando for a work trip, and I don't want to pack a bunch of equipment. And this thing is like half the size of a cell phone and a lav mic, and so it'd be great if this sounds really good, and then I can just sit in the hotel room and record the Chris Spangle Show. Or I may be off that week. I haven't decided yet. I may do the Chris Spangle Show and then have guest hosts for We Are Libertarians. So, anyways, enough of me yakking. You're listening to the Chris Spangle Show. My name is Chris Spangle. And so the main story that I have been touched by is out of Syria. So you may have heard that it's kind of quiet in Syria right now. There haven't been a lot of devastating pictures out of Syria. It is... Let's see here. It's gone on since 2011. After the Arab Spring started, the Tunisian fruit vendor that lit himself on fire, essentially this fruit vendor was being hassled by the local police and constantly paying bribes, and the fruit vendor had just had enough. And very reminiscent of kind of the Eric Garner situation, where Eric Garner, I mean, if you watch that video of Eric Garner basically being suffocated by police officers in New York City, and it's just... You know, he's talking about how just the boot of government is constantly on his neck. I mean, he doesn't put in those framework, but that's sort of where that's a hallmark of tyrannical governments everywhere. And I'm not saying that America is necessarily tyrannical yet, but there are certainly hallmarks of tyrannical behavior in certain sectors of this country, and obviously around the world, especially in the Middle East. And bureaucrats constantly demanding bribes and using mob-like tactics when you don't pay is a hallmark of tyrannical government. And this Tunisian fruit vendor in 2011 was just constantly being picked on. He had a breakdown, lit himself on fire, and that's what started the Arab Spring across the entire Middle East. Tunisia now is in very good shape. They're really kind of the only Arab democracy that's worked. There are, you know, there's still sort of a propped up puppet government in Egypt. Obviously, Syria is the greatest calamity. You know, it's gone on since 2011, and I've got the number from the New York Times here. But let's see, 350,000 people have been killed, and 11 million have fled their homes. And those 11 million have gone up into Germany, have gone into France, have gone into Greece, Turkey, America. I was talking to someone who is a teacher here, right here in the school district that I live in. She was saying, yeah, we have a lot of Turkish students and Syrian students because they're fleeing the governments there, which is really disturbing to hear about Turkey, because Turkey has long been, I mean, they were almost admitted to the EU, and it was an Arab up-and-coming democracy, and Erdogan has essentially turned it into a police state, and Turkey is very nervous about what's about to happen in Syria. And so when that happened, Syria lit on fire, and you had Assad, who was like raised in Western European countries, and his wife looks like an Italian model. You know, he's always wearing the suit and tie. He wasn't like the Saddam Hussein like looking dictator. He was always the guy. He's like an ophthalmologist. And so he always had this rap amongst, you know, the Western world that he was the dictator that everybody could talk to. But then when he saw Mubarak and Egypt and others toppling all through the Middle East and Arab Spring, he just turned into an absolute monster, and he started killing his own people, gassing his own people. Although I do think that some of the gassings that we have seen are false flags. And I don't mean false flags on like the Sandy Hook. I think they're gas attacks perpetrated by one group on their own people to make it look like the other side, namely Assad, gassed their own people in an effort to bring in support. And so what will happen is these groups who are desperate for support from the West will carry out a gas attack, a sarin gas attack, film it, get these horrible pictures, send it to American TV stations in an effort to get the American public to push their legislators to send them aid. And they look at it saying, all right, well, we're going to lose 10 of our own people, but we're going to get millions of dollars, which we'll save in the grand scheme of things. And so sometimes when you hear about gas attacks in Syria, you have to be very careful about immediately blaming Assad, because sometimes it's not Assad, because this is a tactic that has happened time and time again. And it's pretty well known at this point that the 2013 gas attack that prompted the backlash against Obama over the red line, everybody gives Obama crap about this red line, but ultimately no one in the international community could verify that Assad actually carried out the attacks. And that's the same as what happened recently. I think, was it El Baradei? Who was the weapons of mass destruction guy for the UN that was like the main villain for conservatives during the Iraq War? It wasn't El Baradei, but he basically said this last sarin gas attack was sketchy at best. So, but on to Syria. So what's happening there? You know, it's been fairly peaceful. People have seemed to calm down in Syria, but really it's just kind of the calm before the storm. Syria and Iran and Assad are looking to go into this one final province called Idlib. And even the Chinese, which I'll get into in a later, are thinking about helping them in this attack. So let me read from the New York Times. In Idlib, the final offensive in Syrian war may come at a horrific cost. On land, Syria's government is mustering thousands of conscripts to bolster its depleted forces. At sea, a Russian naval flotilla is just offshore, ready to intervene with formidable firepower. In Idlib province, millions of civilians are dreading what comes next. The warring sides in Syria long and The warring sides in Syria's long and merciless civil war are preparing for another brutal offensive, and this one may be the last. The looming assault on Idlib province is the one the government in Damascus hopes will deliver the final military blow against the rebel fighters and their civilian supporters who rose up more than 7 years ago demanding regime change. While Syria and its Russian and Iranian allies see a chance to crush the remaining opposition, Western leaders warn of a humanitarian calamity in Idlib, where an estimated 3 million civilians live. That includes President Trump, who has tweeted about it Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has tweeted about it. Tens of thousands were bused to Idlib as part of a surrender deal with the government. So you have, and so they think there are 30,000 rebel fighters in this province. And this province was, when I looked it up on Google, it was like a few hundred thousand people. And now they have 3.5 million people in this province because this is the province that they shipped people to when the Assad government and the rebel forces would make deals in places like Aleppo, they'd ship refugees to this one province. So it's ballooned up to 3.5 million. And I don't think that's a coincidence that it's right on the Turkish border. So Assad now controls the vast majority of Syria, with the exception of the Kurds. So the Kurds occupy, if you think of America, they occupy like the Northeast. And then this Idlib province is Idaho and Washington. And then Turkey is Canada. And Assad has almost all of the land in Syria, with the exception of a small sliver down in Alabama and Mississippi. And then obviously this Idlib province up in Washington and Idaho. And so the thinking is that Assad, the Russians, and the Iranians are going to push into this province to wipe out those 30,000 rebel forces, but in the process kill hundreds of thousands of remaining refugees. They're going to flee over into the Turkish border, which is going to put greater pressure on Turkey, which in and of itself is on the verge of failure because their currency has been greatly devalued. They're going through a monetary crisis at the moment. They have been greatly destabilized by the amount of Syrian people rushing into Turkey. And so the Turks are in Russia and Iran begging them not to do this offensive because they know that this could be another Aleppo-type scene. Because if you look at Syria, in the aftermath of these conflicts, these towns are completely demolished. So these towns are just gone. Like, I encourage you to go look at Elizabeth Young's reporting on Vice, where she goes to Syria and walks through some of these neighborhoods. It's incredible, the destruction. It looks like Berlin 1942. It looks like Britain 1942. I mean, it's really horrible, and people are living in the middle of this now. You know, conflicts that may have happened 2 years ago in Syria, people are still living in these rubbles. There's still dead bodies everywhere because when the bombing happens and everything collapses and the entire infrastructure, city, provincial governments all collapse in Syria, there's nobody to come in and take these bodies out. And so you're talking about a very populous, dense, there's a lot of density in this province. So to continue on with the times, the impending government offensive against what are believed to be about 30,000 rebel fighters is a perfect storm, says the UN. Turkey, too, is expressing grave concern about an attack, worried it will bear the brunt of the humanitarian security fallout. Attacking the whole at Idlib to eliminate some radical groups would mean causing the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and making 3.5 million people leave their homes one more time, Turkish Foreign Minister, I'm not even going to try, added. Mevlüt Cavusoglu, I will never be a network broadcaster for this reason alone. So more than 350,000 people have been killed and more than 11 million have fled their home. State Department, and this is for where it's relevant to you, if a humanitarian crisis with hundreds of thousands of women, children, and men dying, the elderly dying, doesn't tug at your heartstrings, here's where it relates to you, dear listener. The State Department on Friday also warned in a statement that the United States will respond to any chemical weapons attack perpetrated by the Syrian regime. So in hearing that, the Syrian forces, the Syrian Free Army, says, okay, gas 200 of our people, and Donald Trump is going to do what he did last time, which was go in, kill 150 Russians, clear out an Air Force base for Iran, and significantly weaken the Assad power grid. So, you know, that's why it's dangerous to make these declarations, because it's why it's dangerous for us to be involved in any way, shape, or form, because the second you set the precedent that you're going to return fire for a gas attack, then the Syrian rebel army can then gas their own people, and you attack their... and so it's a way of drawing in America without directly drawing us in. Other Syrian-born fighters, including many who retreated to relative safety in Idlib with their families after years of fighting, now feel cornered and fearful with few options left. So these guys who are fighting in the Syrian Free Army left the army and retired to Idlib as veterans, and now they're worried. Some of the fighters, like Muhammad Darwish, say they are deliberating a withdrawal to Turkish-controlled zones of Syria around towns of Afrin and Jarablus to keep their families safe from the atrocities they have witnessed committed by government forces. Idlib is very densely populated. One barrel bomb can kill dozens, Mr. Darwish said, referring to the indiscriminate aerial weapons used by pro-government air forces on civilian neighborhoods. Because the Russians and Iranians just go in and carpet bomb cities. And so these barrel bombs can kill dozens of people because it's so packed in there. The UN officials say fighting could displace upward of 800,000 civilians from Idlib, yet there is no arrangement to allow safe passage to those who want to escape the fighting. So, huge problem. And from a libertarian standpoint, freedom of movement is a fundamental principle to human freedom. So it is, if you believe in free markets, then you have to believe in free movement of people, okay? Which is why so many libertarians are, in my opinion, correctly open borders. Because if you are, it's like when you saw the closing of the Texas border, you saw the detentions down at the Texas border, you saw people sleeping and starving on bridges outside of the border in America. You saw conflict between American border guards and people trying to come here for asylum. Those are the scenes of a closed border. And so to have a closed border, you rapidly grow the size of the state because you've got to find the people to go out and man the border. You've got to find the weapons that you're going to use to fight people from coming into the border. And so we're not going to have time today, but I'm going to talk tomorrow about legal immigration, which is really what the child separations were about. These were legal immigrants who were being separated. It wasn't illegal immigrants, although you wouldn't understand that or know that if you watched the mainstream media or anybody in the conservative press. So the problem with closed borders is you have to rapidly, massively grow the size of the state to protect those borders. So when you have freedom of movement, people leave the war zones of Syria to go to a place of safety. They leave El Salvador because of their safety, and they go to a place where economic prosperity reigns. And so we'll talk about immigration tomorrow on the Chris Spangl Show, but today we're talking about these immigrants. Where do they go? Europe is not going to accept anymore. America is not going to accept anymore. I haven't heard really anything about the immigration of South Americans, although they're closing their borders to Venezuelans, so they're probably not accepting any of these people. The Turks are adamant that they're not going to accept any. Asian countries are usually fairly closed societies. The Stans are not necessarily good economic opportunities. So, you know, the situation in these refugee camps, when you start bringing more people into refugee camps, the situation just becomes more and more hopeless. I mean, there's people who have been in refugee camps from this situation for almost a decade now. I mean, we're talking about a decade of people living in tents in the desert, and no government on earth wants to deal with them because we have this notion that these women and children and old people, because the men died in fighting, are all terrorists. Like, I think it's foolish to think that there are no ISIS terrorists amongst these refugee camps. They escaped from ISIS and went into refugee camps to escape any punishment. Of course that happened. Okay, but does that mean that all Syrian refugees, all 800,000 people who are going to flee this situation, are terrorists? Absolutely not. And the argument, I'm sorry, of one bad Skittle ruins the bunch doesn't hold water with me. So I think we're not treating our fellow humans very, very nicely. We are propagandizing them and using them as tools, and these people are suffering greatly when America could screen these people and allow them to move into America and live very productive lives. You know, Mike Pence tried to keep all Syrian refugees out of Indiana. Fortunately, I think that was overturned after he left. Hence the Syrians that are now moving into my area, and I'm totally fine with it. Like, I am surrounded by the world's second largest population of the Chin out of Burma because they're fleeing religious persecution. Christians who are fleeing to America because they're being persecuted by Buddhists. A beat for irony there. And they're great neighbors. They're like the sweetest people that you could possibly run into when I see them at the gym or at the grocery store. So another really interesting aspect, this comes from Stratfor, which will make some of the heads explode amongst libertarians, but I try to read everything. I try to look for information from antiwar.com all the way to Stratfor and the Council on Foreign Relations. So you can get facts. It's usually the conclusions from their facts that are wrong. Excuse me, I'm putting myself to sleep. So both China's, so this is from Stratfor, China, Syria. Officials say the Chinese military is willing to help the Syrian army retake Idlib. They write, both China's ambassador to Syria, as well as its military attaché in the country, have raised the possibility of Chinese military operations in Syria alongside the Syrian government. Chinese ambassador Qui Quinjin reportedly stated that the Chinese military is, quote, willing to participate in some way alongside the Syrian army that is fighting the terrorists in Idlib and any other part of Syria. While military attaché Wang Roy Chang reportedly said the Chinese military could participate in an operation to retake rebel-held Idlib if Beijing made the political decision for it to do so. Active Chinese military involvement in Syria would mark a substantial step forward in overall Chinese involvement in the Middle East and in a global sense as well. Except for operations under the UN peacekeeper mandate, China has largely avoided military operations beyond its borders or its immediate region. A military operation in Syria could open the door for further such Chinese involvement around the globe. China has also long been concerned about, and this is really why they're doing it, the Uyghur militants in the Turkestan Islamic Party operating in Idlib. Given the extended combat experience of TIP's Syrian branch and its significant capabilities, Beijing has an interest in seeing the Uyghur militants destroyed before some of them return to Central Asia or even China. Primarily for that reason, it makes sense for China to consider a more active involvement in a battle to retake Idlib. So, they are... The Chinese don't do intervention in the way that the Americans do intervention. We put boots on the ground and get ourselves mired in these quagmires like Vietnam and Iraq. What the Chinese are doing is they're going to places like... They must have read Thomas Sowell or Alexander Hamilton, I guess, may be the better way to put it. So, you know, Hamiltonian... Part of the Hamiltonian philosophy of economic growth is take a central state and plow roads and railroads and create transportation. So you're now going from cut-off areas of a country to central shipping lanes. And so what China is doing is it's going to Central and South America and Africa and other parts of Asia and even the Balkans and investing in infrastructure for these countries. Investing in energy grids, water, waterways, clean water facilities, sewage facilities, even stadiums. and roads and all these other infrastructure projects for these countries. And so that way the Chinese are going to be able to, and they buy the rights for all of the I mean, they're basically doing what the neocolonialists did over the last century in the West. They're going into Nigeria, buying up oil rights and building a road in exchange. And so China is using economic power to spread its influence across the globe, as opposed to its military might, which it certainly could. I mean, if China wanted to spin up its army within a decade, they could be a bigger military than the United States, which is currently the biggest military in the world. I think if you take the United States military and then add up all the other militaries in the world, it's the same size. So China is a formidable foe, you know, and this is a big reason we don't want to be involved in these entangling alliances, because we don't want to be fighting Russia, China, Iran in places like Syria and kill 150 Russians and then have Russia start killing our troops, and then it turns into a hot war. That is the seeds of World War I were formed out of the Italian War in 1909, I believe, 1911. So if you go look at the war that was formed there around Italy, like that was the beginning of it. And so, you know, which led to more alliances, which led ultimately to World War I. So China getting involved in military operations, not a great thing for the world, because we just don't want the Chinese military, like, they're so big, and, like, we just don't want to fight the Chinese too. But it sounds like they're getting involved specifically to go in, commit some atrocities towards this group, so that way these people who will return back to their homes in Asia and China will not have the military experience to take them out, which is how communism basically prospered. I mean, you had these people in exile learning how to be military commanders. They go back to their dictatorial homelands, foment a revolution, and overthrow the government. So now the Chinese are trying to fend off these Islamo-fascist groups, which is an interesting turn in history. So this also, I thought, was a nice summation. So I'll end with this. Also from Stratfor, in an article titled "Russia Considers Its Next Move in Syria." The Syrian civil war has entered a new phase since the government takeover of Dara and Quintiera in the country's southwest. Now, for the first time in the conflict's 7-year history, all meaningful territory in Syria is either under direct control of loyalist forces or subject to significant foreign presence. The Syrian Democratic Forces and allied U.S. troops control the northeastern portion of the country, while Turkish troops are embedded in northern Aleppo province and the Idlib province, where the last of the rebel forces are holding out. Estimates put the cost of reconstruction at about $400 billion, because Russia can't possibly... Now, here's where it gets expensive for you. So the Russians and the Iranians and the Syrians have blown up an entire country, and we have contributed that by sending our own bombs to help fight the Russians, Syrians, and Iranians in Syria. And now we're all going to pay for it. Estimates put the cost of reconstruction at about $400 billion in Syria. Because Russia can't possibly afford to foot the bill on its own, it is turning to other countries, namely the U.S., China, and EU member states, for help. So, even win or lose, although there's no winners in Syria, you will still be paying. So, isn't that lovely? All right, so that is the Chris Spangle Show for today, for September 4th. I want to thank Craig DaCosta for this neat little device, the Zoom F1 Field Recorder. It's always a delight to come home and to see an Amazon package and not know what's in it, and to open it up and have a beautiful wrapping from Amazon and Craig as a birthday present to dear leader. I greatly appreciate it. My birthday is September 9th. So he went to our Amazon wish list and purchased this, and I thank him, and hopefully it sounds good. I don't have headphones in, so I have no idea how it sounds, but we'll take a listen, And hopefully you are pleased. I am pleased. We're all pleased. Because as you know, as dear leader, I want you to be pleased with our product, because you are the listener, or I am the listener, and you are dear leader. So, all right. If you don't listen to We Are Libertarians and you don't get that, then you should. So, all right. Thank you for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.